The loans will provide development and an economic base that will provide full employment and good salaries to all the citizens of the state. And I think we hope that the operating expenses of government will provide services to all Alaska citizens that we feel are needed. But the experience in these other countries has been that a disparity has grown up that has widened between the haves and the have-nots. And certainly I don't think that's what we're intending through any of the programs that have been instituted by the legislature in the years after following our accelerated oil revenues. But I think we're running the same risk. An example is the housing loan programs. The report that's come out from the university says something like 62% of the people who got housing loans already had houses. And something like 90% of the people who got housing loans are over the average income. So the bottom half of our citizens are basically not eligible for housing loans. I think we have to be concerned about that, because if we were to keep going along this track, we may find 10 years down the line that the top half of the income group in Alaska keeps moving up, but the people on the lower half of our economic scale who are just as good as citizens, who all have jobs and pay taxes and work like everybody else, are staying where they're at. And we run the risk of developing an increasing gap in our society between those who have and are getting more and those who have less and are staying where they're at. So I think the permanent fund dividend program is one method we could use to sort of equalize the benefits that are coming from state spending. Again, I want to emphasize, I'm not saying we should stop spending money on operating programs for education and social services, or we should stop our construction programs for basic infrastructure, or not try to have housing loan programs. But I think we should try to institute some kind of system where everybody gets a portion of the oil wealth directly. Some of the things that I think we stand to benefit from this type of distribution, but beyond the equity issue, are the efficiency issue. One of the things, whenever we spend money through government, it sort of could be viewed as a sieve, and we pour the money into the sieve and the benefits trickle down to the citizens. With the direct distribution, we know the money is going to go directly to the citizens. The administrative costs of the Department of Revenue of mailing out the checks are more minimal than any other program we could invent. It also allows citizens to make their own individual choices about how to spend the money for their maximum benefit. One of the complaints that's come up about the permanent fund dividend program and the direct distribution that we sort of confronted when we had the income tax repeal was that if we give money to citizens, then they're going to have higher incomes and they're going to pay more federal taxes. And nobody has been able to figure out a way to avoid that. But some economists have predicted that it's really not as big a problem as it seems when we compare the alternatives. If we were to take $400 million that's being talked about this year, it being put out directly to citizens for permanent fund dividends, citizens will pay increased federal income taxes based on their income bracket. Those people who are in a poverty status probably won't pay much of anything because they're not paying, they're in such a low bracket they wouldn't pay any income tax. People in the high bracket will pay more. But if we were to take that same $400 million and put it into operating expenses of state government and hire $400 million with a state employee, those people are in high income brackets. They will pay a higher amount of federal income tax in total than if we were to pay it out directly in permanent fund dividends. The same thing goes for construction programs. Construction workers are very high income people when we look at the state average income. So we see that, and money going into other programs has the same problem. It is not money that's expended through loan programs, construction programs, or operating expenses. The federal government is still going to get a big bite from that, and in fact they will get a larger bite of the money because of the people who are getting the benefits are in higher income tax brackets than if we distributed to every citizen of the state. So I think that's one problem I know I'd been concerned about and others, and I was glad that some economists actually looked at it and tried to work out the numbers. So I don't think that that's a problem we should worry about in terms of distributing the benefits. One of the problems people have worried about, too, is the in-migration problem. They're saying that, well, there's always sort of this horror case of people that are tourists or other people looking for jobs here about, you can get a handout in Alaska. I think that is a real and justified fear. I don't think we know the answer to it, and we're not going to know until we try it. I think one thing that's been talked about on the House side is a small appropriation to monitor the impacts of the permanent fund dividend distribution. There is no other jurisdiction that we can look to see what the impact of this type of program is. But I think in looking at the impact of permanent fund dividends, we must compare that to other state expenditures for loan programs, capital, or operating expenses, and see what are the distribution of benefits. Does one form of spending cause more in-migration? Does one form of spending cause more money to flow outside the state to outside beneficiaries or to the federal government? And the only way we're going to know the answer to those questions is to do it, and then to also try to monitor the effects of the program. But I think in the last year to 2 years, with the accelerated state spending, we've seen a huge growth of population in the state. So people are moving to the state anyway, and I think it's a natural inclination of people when the economy in the lower 48 is in a depressed state, and Alaska's economy is good, and there's all kinds of national articles appearing on the dichotomy of this, people are just going to move here. I think that's how a lot of people got to Alaska in the first place that were not natives of this state. They came because of the economic opportunities and what they heard on the street about going to Alaska. So I think we're going to continue with that, whether we have permanent fund dividends or any other form of distribution. But again, I think we're not going to really know the answer to these questions. We're going to continue to have theoretical debates in the halls of the legislature and in newspaper columns until we try it and find out. We've tried every other form of state spending that's imaginable. And the only one that we haven't tried up to this point to see whether we can more accurately and more efficiently get benefits to all citizens of the state is the distribution program. I think we'd all hoped for that when the permanent fund dividend program was passed. But we haven't been able to do that because of the court case. I think the legislation before you is a good attempt to make sure that regardless of what happens with the court case, that the state would go forward and distribute some wealth benefits directly to citizens. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Ferguson.
Have you given any thought to the 18-year-olds, say given to the younger children under a trust fund?
Yes, I think is that after we had, when the original permanent fund dividend bill was passed, I was a supporter of giving it, allowing children to have the same benefits. That was not a majority position at the time, and it was certainly no reason I wanted to vote against the legislation because it wasn't included. After that, I had a constitutional attorney looking at some of the other constitutional problems, and he was the first one to bring up that he thought there was a big equal protection problem, and since then, I think most attorneys have agreed it was not a question we looked at the time. It just wasn't looked at in that light, and that we are in a vulnerable position unless we include children. I think the only debate should be over whether we allow parents to directly apply for the dividends for their children now, or whether that should be escrowed. I personally favor parents being able to apply for that dividend now, and so that those benefits flow immediately to those families.
Mr. Chairman, the Susan Burke will be up, but the bill does include that, but it does include the they receive it at age 18, and there are some things in the bill that tie into how you start to establish the residency. So they are included, but there is the difference in that point.
Do you have a breakdown on the different methods of distribution as it relates to the amount of money paid to abortion you see in the form of taxes? What you're saying is that the equal distribution is the least amount of money that goes towards
right.
taxes.
This was
I
can get that. This was some information that Greg Erickson presented to the House Finance Committee, and I think it was the first time anybody really looked at that and could get that information for you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, there is in your all the material that you have there a memo from Representative Malone and Gardner, just with a little topical report on some of those areas, but you'll make that available. I might point out, Representative Gardner, that the program evaluation you referred to on the ISER housing study done by Legislative Budget and Audit might be the kind of a monitoring system that could be incorporated to see how the program actually works. In other words, you get the primary and secondary benefits. I think that would be good to establish a procedure for that immediately so you could find out when this goes through just what the effect is on the economy. I think that's a good suggestion.
I think you do want to look at this issue of in-migration because it is a fear and it's justifiable that a lot of citizens have. And I've heard a lot of testimony of people saying that they thought it was a good idea except for that, and because of their fear of that, you know, people moving up here, it sort of ruined their whole idea about it. And it is something that we should try to factually establish, but again, you have to compare it to putting money into construction projects. If that, it's a question of which causes the greater in-migration rather than whether it causes any. I'm sure it will cause some.
Mr. Chairman, do you think we're vulnerable in as much as that we're requiring a 6-month residency rather than a 30-day?
Well, in listening to all the attorneys, I think the best way to approach the resident question is sort of ask 10, take a vote, and see how you come out. And that's sort of what we've done. And I think the 6 months is a good balance between something that is more workable and stands a very high chance of being upheld. We've asked attorneys, not publicly, because we asked some of them that were on the other side what they thought of this, and I think there's a pretty good consensus that 6 months is not guaranteed, but it stands a very high probability of being proved. Everybody seems to agree 30 days would work, but I think the problem with 30 days is it runs such a high risk, a much higher risk of causing in-migration, and a lot of people in the public perception getting the money that shouldn't have, that would cause a lot of people to turn against the program. So although it would be safer to go with 30 days, I think it would, the program would work so much, would work worse, and I don't think it's worth sort of being blackmailed into just going with 30 days because somebody might challenge it. I think there is a possibility that somebody might challenge it, but I think not. We've had some, you know, a lot of residency requirements on our loan programs and other benefits, and I don't think people challenge those programs because they said, well, if it's 6 months or a year, I'll soon be eligible too, so why bother? It'll take you more than 6 months to get through court, and by that time, if you were intended to be here, you would be eligible. I think people were willing to challenge the original dividend because it seemed to them that they would never be equal, right? That even if they stayed here for 20 years, the other people who have been here 20 years before would always be ahead of them. But nobody's ever challenged their loan programs, even though they have 1, 2, 3 years requirement, because I think they all thought, well, I'll be a citizen soon and be entitled to the same thing everybody else. So I don't think that, you know, that it's, people might, probably won't challenge it on that basis. Anyway.
Senator Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You made reference to the provision about the children under age 18 and the fact that you personally felt like that distribution should be available to parents, and yet that provision isn't in here. Are there other areas of concern that you have that are not addressed in this particular piece of legislation?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think this legislation is pretty comprehensive and similar to legislation that's been worked on the House side. There has been some question about the some of the contingency provisions in here. This is some issue that's come up from some of the attorneys who have looked at this, who felt that some of the contingency provisions at the end of the bill that sort of tried to say, well, if the Supreme Court does this, then we'll do that, and lays out several scenarios. A lot of attorneys have advised that they don't think that that that's a very good approach, both policy and legally, and you might want to hear from some people. I think the Attorney General's office feels that these are a good approach, but there's other attorneys who feel differently on it, and I think that's one issue the committee might want to examine. It is sort of a legal question that I'm personally don't have the expertise to recommend one way or the other.
In the interest of time, because we do have a couple of large bills and a number of people that need to be heard, Susan Burke will speak to this issue of the minors, and I don't know if you have anything, Terry, you could get to us. There are quid pro quos on both sides of that issue as to whether they receive the dollars now. There are a great deal of information from the ANILCA, from the Native Land Claims, and some problems of dispersing to minors, and it becomes a judgment call and a policy issue, I think. So, get more information.
In answer to Senator Stimson's question, one of the difficulties that I'm trying to resolve on the House side is that in the distribution of dividends to the people in the state, particularly when they're distributed to minors, the problem compounds, is that we're faced with the reality of a very regressive federal assistance structure. And in some cases, the payment of a dividend to a family or members of a family may, because of the very strange way that our Congress has constructed our federal assistance laws, cost the people more than the value of the dividend. Now, the actual amounts of those costs have been estimated by the Department of Health and Social Services. There's some attempt in legislation in both the House and in this bill here to offset some of those, but depending on whether all the costs or part of them are picked up, for instance, limiting it to certain basic medical coverage might involve hold harmless costs. We want to provide them on about $1.5 million, or it could run, if we're going to offset all lost federal payments, depending on the distribution, between $7.5 and $11 million a year. And I don't think that's a reason not to do the program. I think it just outlines that the U.S. Congress and the federal assistance efforts have never really been able to come to grips with the reality. I think we should do that in the adoption of a bill this year. I don't think people at the very bottom of the economic ladder should be hurt by a program that's going to help most people. And I think the legislature should take that into account.
Senator Simpson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Malone, if we were able to put together a plan that would accommodate those folks that would be like on AFDC and so that they wouldn't get hurt, that $7.5 to $11 million that you referred to, can that money actually come out of the permanent fund earnings, or would that be general fund revenues?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would depend on structure the law for the payment of permanent fund dividends. Certainly it could come out of the permanent fund earnings. In other words, the total dividends could be reduced in an amount necessary to pay these costs so that you didn't have to go into the general fund. You could use a permanent fund dividend account. But I think my main point is that it's a fact of life that's imposed by an artificial and not a very thoughtful assistance effort by the federal government.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Malone. Did you have specifics on that $7.5 to $11 million figure that hasn't been made available to us, or is that your guesstimate from talking with Health and Social Services of the impact?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cliff Groh Jr. has been the staff person on the House side on this issue, and he has that information.
You could make that available.
And those are estimates provided by the State Department of Health and Social Services. I don't think it's an argument against the program. I think there are strong economic and political arguments in favor of the program, but it is an issue that, in all fairness, should be dealt with.
Mr. Chairman, one last question to Representative Malone. In your opinion, is there a very real sense of urgency about dealing with this piece of legislation during this session?
Mr. Chairman. Sometimes sense of urgency depends on a sense of values. But if you turn this thing around, you know, look at it as a cash distribution, and it's what it is, looked at the effect of you would have if, suppose this program were in operation and you decided to terminate it. Well, that would cost people in the state, depending on the form of the program, as individuals, it might cost them someplace between $500 and $1,000 a year, or several thousand dollars per year per family doing that. So if you had something that that represented that much income to people and decided to terminate it, it'd be a pretty heavy tax to levy on them, I'd say. And failure to enact the program, I think, denies benefits of that order of magnitude. I think that one of the best arguments for doing something now was raised by Mr. Erickson in his presentation to the House Finance Subcommittee on the issue, in that the positive economic impacts of this type of program would help to offset the negative impacts occurring from a decline in state revenues generally. And so I think that is a reason to do it this year.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher was going to wait, but due to the time here, I think we should come forward now.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Victor Fisher, Senator. Mr. Chairman, I would like to deal with one particular issue, and that is the effect on low-income families in Alaska of the proposed distribution.
Yes. If I could just point out for those of you, it is a complex bill. If you take a look in it, would help, I think, give reference to Senator Fisher's remarks. On page 6, where we're dealing with section 4323085, and in your analysis, and that might help a bit. Excuse me, Senator Fisher, for interrupting.
Right. Madam Chair, I would suggest that you not even bother looking at that section, because I think it is totally inadequate. It doesn't even scratch the surface.
No, I wanted to show that it would be different from what you have to say.
I had planned to refer to it. Let me first say that I do strongly favor the concept of sharing Alaska's oil wealth with the citizens of Alaska. And as Representative Gardner said, if we can equalize the benefits, if the benefits go to all Alaskans, I'm certainly in favor of that. My concern is with the effect of the distribution plan as presently composed, and of any plan, on the low-income people of Alaska, particularly the children, women, old Alaskans, and the disabled. I believe, and I don't have the exact figures, but we're talking of maybe 50,000, 60,000 or more people who might be negatively impacted by the distribution. In other words, they would not receive their equitable share. And in some cases, the poorest of the poor might actually lose money if they receive the dividend. This could actually be a disaster for some of the poorest Alaskans. And for example, we had a series of meetings with some of the representatives and their staff and with the Division of Public Assistance, and it became clear that there are situations where a poor family might receive $1,000 dividend and in the process lose $1,500 in federal assistance and some state assistance at a minimum, and could possibly lose a lot more under various circumstances. Provision in the proposed committee substitute on general relief medical, as I mentioned, is totally inadequate. It deals with just one tiny little aspect of the problem. The impact is not just on Medicaid, which is what this would deal with, and only partly deal with Medicaid. It would also affect other federal state programs such as AFDC, food stamps, old age assistance, energy assistance, daycare, public housing, public defenders' eligibility, and various other programs. And Representative Malone spoke of a possible substitution of state funds for loss of federal funds to the tune of $11 to $12 million. I believe the figure is somewhere in there. It hasn't been quite determined. And I would say that is, as he suggested, a small price to pay if we want to go ahead and distribute the permanent fund dividends. I would like, with your indulgence, to bring out just some aspects to of some of the programs that would affect the low-income families. First of all, we have AFDC, which aid to families with dependent children. And here, as of November 81, we had 13,598 households receiving AFDC. And this generally consists of one parent, usually a woman, and two or more children. If AFDC recipients received a $1,000 dividend, 95% of these families would be terminated from the program until the $1,000 is spent. Now, if the $1,000 was spent in 1 month, you know, let's assume they understood this and quickly spent it on the washing machine or whatever else, or bought a supply of food, that would be sort of the minimal case where they would be off AFDC for 1 month. Losing the AFDC grant would affect not just the basic AFDC payment, but also food stamps and Medicaid. And these are state-federal programs shared 50% by the federal government. Let me just mention that to be eligible for AFDC, a family of three, a parent and two kids, cannot have a monthly income of over $508, which is a pretty low amount. The monthly AFDC grant then is $460, and if plus a potential food allotment of $283, if there is no other income to the family. So we're talking of a family that would, at a minimum, lose out. I mean, they might receive $1,000, and under the best of circumstances, they would lose only some $740 or $50, so that they might still be $250 to the good, all other factors being equal, which they are not going to be equal. Let me, as an aside, mention that there is no way that these people can say, oh, well, I don't want to receive the permanent fund dividend. Under the federal regulations governing these programs, they would have to apply and would have to receive the permanent fund dividends. They would have to apply for the funds. There's no way they can't just sort of opt out and say, well, this is going to cost me too much. I don't want to do it. The problems begin only now. I might say that during this period of non-eligibility, the individual is liable to be, have other costs and other burdens imposed, which could eat up to $250. It is estimated that about 95% of AFDC families would have to be terminated from AFDC if a permanent fund dividend were distributed. This is, again, more about 13,000 families. Now, they would go off the AFDC rolls. That would mean that they would have to reapply. They would have to fill out a horrendous application. It's a very I have copies here if you'd like to see them. It's a difficult application, and each of those applicants would have to be interviewed. That's a long process, and the Division of Public Assistance does not have the staff and the resources to process 13,000 applications in a month after the distribution occurs. The state law requires that eligibility determinations be made within 30 days. Federal law requires 45 days. In fact, in urban areas, the eligibility processing takes at least 30 days, at least 40 days. And with the impact of all these additional families, we might be talking of people being off AFDC, being off food stamps, and being off Medicaid for a period of more than 3 months. It might be more than 4 or 5 months. Let me go on and mention that it also affected would be old age assistance, which is a federal program where income eligibility is a key. Here we're talking of blind, of aid to the blind, old age assistance and assistance to the disabled. And the caseload here in November of 81 was close to 4,500. So here we have another very direct impact. Food stamp eligibility would be directly affected because of income changes. The Federal Energy Assistance Program would be directly affected. And here we have more than 1,400 households that would be affected. Then we have various programs such as daycare, public housing, and so on. And I won't go into these details. As I mentioned before, the general relief medical that is provided for in the committee, proposed committee substitute, simply doesn't deal with the basic problem that I'm raising here. I think that we need provisions, an across-the-board provision, to make sure that with respect to all state programs, at the very least, eligibility will not be affected. Beyond that, I believe that we should take the next step and consider substituting state money for federal money. There's a way of doing this whereby putting federal, in effect, going off federal programs and not accepting federal money for 1 month and substituting state funds, we would then be in a position of, in effect, not stopping eligibility under federal programs. Single month would simply be blanked out with respect to federal eligibility, and these families I'm talking about could come right back onto the federal roll in the subsequent month. The other provision, Mr. Chairman, that I would recommend you consider is separate from what I've been discussing so far, and that deals with child support. I would suggest to the committee that child support payments not be exempted from garnishment. Under all of these proposals, 50% of dividends are exempt from execution. Now, 70% of the Child Support Enforcement Agency caseload consists of non-AFDC recipients, and parents under state law, both civil and criminal, have a duty to support their children. And child support payments are not allowed to be discharged in bankruptcy, and the exemption should not apply here either. That there's some parents who are more than 10,000, 15,000 behind in their payments, and this shouldn't be a bonus to them. This would, to me, so far as I'm concerned, this is the one important exemption from the exemption with respect to garnishment income. Thank you very much, and I do hope you'll consider these issues as you go ahead.
Any questions, Senator Fisher? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I just make note that we had just delivered from Legislative Legal, it says LEER 4882, the draft that has gone through the revisor and legal services. And there should be no substantive changes, but obviously we'll have to review that in detail. The next we should hear from would be Susan Burke, who's done substantive work on this. Susan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Susan Burke. I'm an attorney here in Juneau, formerly the Assistant Attorney General in charge of dividends. And when I left state service, both the Department of Law and the Governor's Office asked me not to abandon the dividend ship, but to continue on contract to assist them with the drafting and some of the legal issues. So here I am doing just that.
We should ask her about rocky shores and sandbars and all kinds of
things. I'll try to refrain from metaphors if I can, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, I think since you've been provided with a fairly detailed sectional analysis, what might be the best thing to do would be for me to just summarize the bill in a general way and then talk about some of the issues that I think are probably the more important issues in the bill and perhaps in with respect to technical aspects of the dividend distribution. In general, the bill that is in your packet with draft law on the top of it, as opposed to the reworking by the legislative affairs people, is the original governor's introduction with some changes that I proposed we put in, some of which have been reviewed with Senator Sturgiolowski. but for all intents and purposes, it's still the governor's bill, the proposed committee substitute. In general, the bill is intended to do a couple of things. First of all, it's intended to provide a backstop for a distribution system in the event that we get an unfavorable ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court in the pending litigation. And it provides for two alternative contingencies, two different backstop programs that would take effect depending upon what the court tells us. In addition to that, the bill also makes some changes in the existing law that we think on further reflection are important to make, primarily including children in the program. The first alternative backstop program would be a per capita distribution. Everyone each year who qualified would receive an equal amount. Unlike the existing law that provides for a minimum dividend with loans, the possibility of loans from the general fund in order to meet that minimum amount, this, under all of the alternatives presented in this bill, we would simply be distributing one half of the distributable permanent fund income, period. We would not be using any general fund earnings. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, now that the earnings are getting a bit larger, you really can provide a decent dividend just using half the earnings. Furthermore, what I view and the governor views as one of the primary purposes of dividend distribution is to create a kind of personal stake on the part of the public, the citizens of Alaska, in the permanent fund itself. And the closer that tie is between the dividend amount and the permanent fund and the income it produces and the amount of money that's in it, the more tailor-made the dividend distribution program is to that purpose. Adding general fund money to it tends to dilute that link. One of the primary issues in the per capita distribution system is the inclusion of a 6-month residency requirement for eligibility. Anytime you put a residency requirement in a program that's over 30 days, there's a risk. A flag is raised, and the constitutional durational residency flag, right to travel questions, get raised. There's no question about that. We think that I've reviewed it, and unless we get a very peculiar ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court in the dividend case along very traditional right to travel durational residency lines, and they change their mind about durational residency, we think that this is supportable, and there are lots of good reasons for it. Most of those are outlined in the governor's transmittal letter, and I won't go into them now. But I caution you that there is a risk, and we've told the governor that there is some risk. The next issue is children, and not so much whether you include them or not, because I'm convinced, particularly after strong signals from the state Supreme Court in the permanent fund dividend decision, that there was a serious vulnerability if you did not include children. I don't think the issue is whether to include them or not, it's how to include them. The governor has, we've reviewed this and the options and alternatives, and I think the only two remotely workable options are payments directly, immediately to children through parents or guardians, or the approach that we've taken here, which is setting the money aside from year to year, waiting till children turn 18 and letting them claim their dividends in what we've called here prior year dividends. There are a lot of policy questions that can be raised about both. I think the one of the primary reasons that we chose not to include a provision for immediate payment were practical and administrative ones, although once again there are lots of policy questions in addition to that. The experience that everyone had, including the state, with the native claim settlement payments that went directly to children, it sounds easy. Sure, parents apply and you simply, or guardians apply. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of people don't have legal, they're not living with their parents, and yet they don't have legal guardians. You don't have to have a court tell you whether you're an adult or not. That happens automatically by virtue of the passage of time. But guardianship is a legal concept, and it requires a court order, someone coming forward willing to act as guardian. There are a large number of children in the state who are wards of the state. And, you know, does health and social services then apply for their dividends, and what do they do with the money once they get it, and so forth and so on. There are lots of problems. The native claim distributions for children went into litigation, and the case is still open. The problems still haven't been solved. And that it's been, I don't know how many years in litigation. There doesn't seem to be a good solution that's really agreeable to everyone in terms of solving those problems.
Mr. Chairman, Susan, could you make a comment? It was a good comment made in the testimony. If the dividends went out immediately to minors, that would just make worse this problem of federal payments, would it not?
I think it would, yes.
Well, would it or not? Do you see that it would raise income levels and have an impact if the minor received it?
I'm not an expert on welfare law and eligibility. I believe that's true.
That's an area I think we need to check.
Uh-huh. And that's yet another reason why you might seriously consider the governor's approach. On the welfare question and how to deal with welfare recipients, the governor has an open mind on this question and always has had. It's a difficult question. Senator Fisher raised some important questions and some good questions. We took the approach we did in this bill largely as a result of talking with people in the Department of Health and Social Services who are familiar with the program. We really just took their advice on it and included this. This, by the way, is the approach that, so far, anyway, the House seems to be taking. I don't think the final numbers have been put together as to what the impact would be of receipt of dividends on the one hand. On the other hand, what the price tag would be to try to provide a complete hold harmless sort of thing. And as I say, I think the governor has an open mind, excuse me, on this issue. But I'm quite certain that, like you, he would want to look at any price tag before he actually made took any firm position on which way that issue ought to go. There's one other element in the, going back briefly to the children, there's been some concern expressed with respect to waiting until children turn 18 and then letting them come back later and apply, and that is the potential for fraudulent claims. We included in this substitute that was not in the original bill a mechanism for at least providing a means for the department to be able to verify later a prior year claim. This would not be the only way that you could prove eligibility, but it would at least provide children with a sort of easy track for determining eligibility without having to provide the department with school records and all kinds of other elements of proof. One aspect of that, I was a little bit troubled myself with the idea of the Department of Revenue with this event. clarifying these eligibility claims and to provide estimates to help them figure out whether they've got enough money or too little money in the dividend account. The second alternative that is proposed in the bill would be if we, in the event that we get an unfavorable decision, and depending upon what the court says, the program, the backstop program, would be essentially the program that we have, but with one difference. Under the existing program, you get one dividend for each year of residency, and it accumulates from year to year. Under the existing program, you begin counting those years going back to statehood. There were questions raised both in the briefs and by justices of the state Supreme Court and the U.S. Supreme Court concerning that particular feature. It's possible, and I don't think it's a huge possibility, but I think there's some possibility, that if we get an unfavorable decision, it could be simply on the basis that we went back to 1959. The court might well tell us that it's perfectly all right to have accumulated dividends based on years of residency, but only if you start counting those years from the present moving forward. There are a couple of aspects to accumulated distribution that we think are very good benefits of that. One of the primary one being, you know, once again, the whole purpose of this is to make people care about the permanent fund, give them choices in a sense, or personal stake in how state money is spended. You know, do you build a dam or do you put the money in the permanent fund? The other part of it is caring about the permanent fund and how it's managed and how it produces its income. And with respect to that link that is trying to be made, we think that it's important not just for people to think about what the permanent fund is going to be throwing off by way of earnings and income currently, in the current year, but it's important for people to be thinking about what it's going to look like 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and 20 years from now. If a person knows that in 20 years their dividends will have increased geometrically by the time that 20th year is reached, we think that that will instill a greater interest in what the fund looks like 20 years from now, 20 times more than what they care about what it looks like today. And we think that's important, and that was really why we went to a cumulative distribution system in the first place. For that reason, I think it's important, if we have that loophole, if you will, in an unfavorable decision, to provide for that alternative. I think it's something of a long shot, and I will grant you that, and I've told the governor that, but it doesn't hurt anything to put it in the bill, and I think it's worth providing for that contingency should it arise. There have been some questions raised, and I think they're good questions, about, well, how do we know whether the court said that? Lawyers, of course, argue over commas, you know, think what they'll do over a U.S. Supreme Court opinion. And I guess my answer to that is this administration is totally committed to the idea of dividend distribution. And I think the last thing that the governor wants or the attorney general wants is litigation over whether the attorney general has interpreted the Supreme Court decision correctly in terms of which of these contingencies go into effect. And I think I can say almost with certainty that unless the U.S. Supreme Court opinion is crystal clear and there really aren't any arguments about what the court has told us with respect to this prospective accumulation, that you're not going to have the Attorney General coming out and saying, well, that's what the U.S. Supreme Court said. The provisions that are starting, I think, along about Section 5 of the bill are intended to apply both to the existing program if we win, or to this prospective accumulation. It simply amends the existing statutes. It includes children in almost identical words to the way that they would be included under the per capita system. The welfare sections, once again, we have not included a section, and I guess I view that something as a drafting oversight. The welfare questions are important, and I think that whatever you decide to do on the welfare question, we should include a section in this bill that does the same thing for existing law. It was not included in this bill, and I think it probably should be. The other, the other changes are fairly straightforward. Finally, in section 9 of our draft, we have provision for the 1982 permanent fund dividend distribution. If we lose the case, and no matter which of the contingent alternatives ultimately goes into effect to govern 1983 distribution, the 1982 distribution would be a per capita distribution of $1,000 per person. The eligibility requirements for 1982 would be virtually the same as the per capita system, the 6 months residency requirement and so forth. Because people have been waiting so long for their dividends, we thought it was important to try to have some mechanism for payment as early as possible. So we've included a provision that people, that the department can use the applications and the information that are on the applications that they're currently receiving this year under the existing program for this 1982 distribution. And there's sufficient information in that application to be able to apply the 6 month residency requirement and so forth, so that the money could go out very quickly after an unfavorable ruling, should that come to pass. This section would go into effect immediately after an unfavorable ruling, so we think that the payments under this could go out relatively quickly. There's one other section that we've included in this committee substitute that we talked about very recently with the governor, and I have not had a chance to discuss this one with Senator Sturgiolowski. And that is a repeal under the existing law of the section that allows for general fund loans and a minimum dividend of $50. I talked earlier about why we think it's important to go back just to permanent fund income. But there are a couple of aspects to that. If we do that, the dividend amounts are obviously going to be pretty under $50. And although they will be decent enough not to be embarrassed to pay them out, if you have to pay back out of each year's, half of each year's permanent fund earnings, the loans that have previously been made from the general fund, you drastically lower the dividend amounts for the next few years. And of course, you're not pumping back any additional loans into it to buck up the minimum dividend. And for that reason, this repealer in Section 11 of the bill really is a kind of trade-off. You go to half the earnings of the permanent fund, but you forgive the loans that have been made so far. You know, it provides a decent dividend in the future, and you stop general fund contributions at the same time. I think those are the major, I think I've touched on all of the major issues. If I've missed one.
Senator Stimson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under a direct distribution program, would there be any provision for those individuals that would prefer not to receive the dividend payment?
A person who did not want to receive the dividend payment simply wouldn't apply. Now, I don't know if you're relating that to the welfare issue. You know,
that's apparently a separate question.
That's a separate question. Yeah, but under, I don't think that the problems with the, I suppose, constructive receipt under the welfare eligibility would apply to federal income taxes, for example. Which reminds me of one other thing I've included in the per capita that is in the existing program. And that is a provision that would allow the Department of Revenue to adopt a plan or program for tax shelters, if you will. It was included back in 1980 originally in the hope that an IRS-approved deferred compensation kind of program could be put together so that people who were concerned about the federal tax bite could shelter their dividend. That just didn't work.
Now, why didn't that work?
Because you had in order to be under a deferred compensation program under the IRS regulations, you have to have an employer-employee relationship.
I see.
And although we have lots of state workers, not everybody's a state worker.
Mr. Chair?
Could I pursue that just a little bit further? Let's say an individual would like to have the opportunity to take their dividend and turn it back over to the state, just for general fund purposes or something like that. Did you have any discussions along those lines?
You can. That's a fascinating idea.
Give it back.
I guess to tell you the truth, the thought that anyone would do that to me sounds so remote that I never really thought very much about it. You can do whatever you want to with your dividend. For tax purposes, if you simply give it back to the state, you'd probably be taxed on it. I don't think the state is considered to be a charitable organization. But only for purposes of charitable contributions under the tax law. Some might suggest that it was charitable in any number of ways. Obviously, you could contribute it to, you know, an authorized, what tax lawyers call 501c3 organizations, and you would get a tax shelter that way. The other thing that people have begun to talk about, which is why I included the provision allowing the department to put a plan together, under the Economic Recovery Act of 1981, the individual retirement account option, the rules have just been opened way up, and there are lots and lots of things that can be done. And that's certainly an option that I think is well worth exploring. You know, certainly you could take your dividend down to your bank and let them set up an IRA account, but from what I have read and talked to the people who've been thinking about it, it may be that a state-sponsored one would have lots of economies of scale, and you could simply check a box on your dividend application, please put this in an IRA account. It's very much in the early stages of thinking and conceptualizing and so forth, but I wanted to put at least the authorization. There's currently authorization to do that in the existing program. The language is very general, the old deferred comp language, and I put similar language into the per capita.
So that could be possible under this committee substitute.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of things. Susan, I would ask that some research do be done to check the ability to use the state funds instead of federal funds. Is there a way we can substitute those and keep those programs going?
On the welfare?
Yeah, on the welfare issue. So that we can, is there a way we can, apart from the cost issue, get into the hold harmless? And then I have, after finished questioning you, a couple of questions from Mr. Wall from the Department of Revenue. One of the things that I'd like to know if we legally can take from the dividends accumulated, one, the hold harmless, and also the question of the operation of the program, and to use program receipts as opposed to general fund. And I don't know if there's a problem there, but we need to get that straightened out.
Senator Lushing.
Yeah, there's a possibility also of classifying certain people as loans, open-ended loans, rather than dividends.
And
what the federal government's received, instead of receiving a dividend,
if you don't have to repay it, and it's fairly clear to the federal government that that's the case, they would consider it income. Just calling it a loan isn't enough. You really have to have a debtor, a true debtor-creditor relationship, and there has to be legal obligation to pay the loan back, and so forth.
What I'm saying, I'm not convinced that we can't find a way of doing it.
If you have any provision for forgiving the loan.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about loans specifically. Different other methods of disbursement would not require them to borrow for these programs. Or whatever term you want to use.
It's hard for me to talk about the legalities of the welfare thing. I think the people from the Department of Health and Social Services, even if they're not lawyers, they're a lot better lawyers on this question than I am. Most, I know, to the extent that I know anything about it, there are, it's not just money, but resources are counted in the eligibility requirements as well. And as long as you're giving value to people, and it's discernible value, whether it's cash dollars or whether you give everyone a brand new automobile every year, I think it's going to have an effect on the eligibility.
Well, in effect, if you're accumulating credits over a period of time, if you paid off when you're 18, that would probably have an effect also, right?
No, because it's what you have available to you at the moment. The way we've structured this, a child, an individual child, doesn't have any individual right to that money as they're growing up. It's simply set aside in a pool. Their entitlement comes only if they apply after they become 18. The money is not available to them in any way. And, you know, once again, the social assistance people can give you a more accurate reading than I. But I'd be amazed if, given the fact that that money is absolutely not available to them in any way, that it would be counted under this. But experts, I've been proved wrong by experts before, and I expect I will again.
Mr. Chairman, I would hope that you've indicated we might continue this at 1:30 today. I hope that would be agreeable, and also the permanent fund management. But we should hear from Ron Bailey, from the Health and Social Services Public Assistance, and Gordon Landis. We should also hear from Phil Wall from the Department of Revenue. And I wonder if we can explore your questions now. We might get additional answers from Health and Social Services.
I think you'll get a lot better answers.
Will you be available
absolutely
this afternoon?
Sure.
But go ahead, Senator. Well, we need to find there was a policy decision made by the governor's office on this one. It's a very difficult one, and we're starting to get hold of some figures on it, and I think it certainly deserves some consideration, and we'll get the information that the House staff has prepared on this, too, and I'll try and have that for you at 1:30 today.
In view of the time, Commissioner, how long were you going to testify?
I'd like to just make 5 minutes of remarks on the bill. Which would include an overview of what the fiscal notes mean, but it obviously would not go into the backup of the justification.
Would you be available at 1:30 shortly after this afternoon? We've only got about 5 minutes. We've got to leave for the floor.
I understand. I really appreciate the courtesy of 5 minutes now, and I would be available at 1:30.
Come forward.
Good. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Tom Williams, and I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. And I just would like to make two very important, at least I feel they're very important points, about some of the issues that have arisen during the testimony this morning on the permanent fund dividend bill. First of all, is that it is absolutely imperative that we have a distribution program that is not just one shot, that it's an ongoing program. The purpose of permanent fund dividends, whether it accrues and gets larger over time or whether it's flat per capita each year, the purpose is to have the people see their direct self-interest in the good management of the permanent fund and in the setting aside of additional monies into the permanent fund. The second, and this is a critical point, is that it's important to remember where we are right now with the permanent fund dividend program. Although the Superior Court judge ruled against us, we won. We won in the state Supreme Court. And even a tie vote in the U.S. Supreme Court, if for some reason one of the justices does not participate in the decision, a tie vote means we still have won. Got to be 5 justices to vote against us before we lose. Right now we have a victory on the present permanent fund dividend program. And the important point to make is, every problem that Senator Fisher pointed out this morning exists, will exist, when we win. In other words, we're talking in this bill about replacing what we have today. The problems of the welfare people are real problems, and it's not that I'm not sympathetic to them, because I'm very sympathetic to them, but I think it's a subject for a different bill from this one. This bill is talking about what happens if the court loses. I don't expect us to lose. The fact that it's taken the court this long to make up its mind suggests to me that they're dealing with the more difficult opinion writing of explaining how this case fits in their line of earlier cases and let us do it than to strike it down. So I'm encouraged by the delay, although I'm frustrated by it. The important thing is, and a point I really want to emphasize, is that Senate Bill 842 is to replace the permanent fund dividend program, and that's the subject matter of this bill. The welfare problems that may be caused by a distribution program, whether it's under the present law or whether it's under some law that replaces it, need to be addressed regardless, but in a different context, I think, because they will be there when we win. And this is just a backstop in the, in my opinion, less likely event of a loss. I appreciate that. I'll go into the fiscal notes and so on this afternoon, but I wanted to make that point this morning while it was still in the front of everybody's minds.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, aren't we attempting to address in this bill the concern with the rights of the children's dividends, regardless of what happens with that U.S. Supreme Court decision?
Certainly, but that doesn't have to do with welfare.
I know, but why isn't it also appropriate then that we try to take care of our concerns about the welfare recipients at the same time?
Because welfare recipients, the effects that flow to them are, I believe, a different subject matter. The distribution program confined to people 19 years and above, or 18 years and above, has constitutional problem with it, which our state Supreme Court indicated it felt uncomfortable with, although it didn't actually give direct expression or opinion on it. In light of that expression of discomfort, simple prudence says, let's deal with that. You don't have a constitutional problem. What you have is a moral problem, one of responsibility to people who are unable to help themselves or need help in helping themselves. But it's not of a constitutional dimension. It's not actually part of the process of creating a dividend program. Problems that are caused in a welfare area are best addressed by a welfare bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, very briefly, I appreciate what you're saying, but I think that the very real problems that are created are probably more important to us than the constitutional problems. If this is going to go in effect, and especially if the U.S. Supreme Court does rule favorably, then it seems to me like it's important that at the same time we're dealing with these other concerns, we're trying to make that as fair and reasonable to the folks that are stand the chance of being in jeopardy as a result of this. And I appreciate what you're saying, but I don't see how we put together another piece of legislation between now and the time this session ends to deal with that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may reply, the point is, suppose that this legislation does not pass, and suppose that we win in the Supreme Court. You're going to have to pass some sort of legislation to deal with whatever problems are created in the welfare area regardless. It seems to me that you have to look, and even if this legislation does pass, you're still going to have to deal with the welfare problems that would be created when we win in the Supreme Court. And so you're going to have some sort of welfare bill regardless to deal with the likely possibility of victory. And this bill is only addressing the possibility of defeat. So you're going to have that bill to deal with the welfare problems regardless, because we've got a program on the books fully administered. All we have to do is press the green light on the computer, essentially. A little bit more than that, but not much. And the checks start going into the mail. And all the consequences that will flow from that will happen automatically.
I'm sorry, we're short on time. Maybe we can pursue this this afternoon.
I'd look forward to that.
It's the intent to continue these hearings this afternoon at 1:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll also include the other bill. Tom.
In that the meeting was recessed, it's not necessary to have a quorum in order to continue the meeting. The meeting was called to order. There's a duly seated quorum this morning. Based on that, Senator Sertus.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. There are two areas I think we need to complete. One, if the commissioner could come up and possibly, he'd like to bring Phil Wall, Mr. Wall, to talk about the fiscal notes that were given to us this morning, what it would take to implement the plan. Then I think we should hear from Health and Social Services regarding the issue that was raised regarding welfare recipients.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, my name is Tom Williams. And with me is Phil Wall. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue, and Phil is the Director of the Public Services Division of the Department of Revenue. The fiscal notes that we've provided here for Senate Bill 842 are predicated on the assumption that the Supreme Court strikes down the present PFD program. What that would mean is that the budget requests already in the governor's budget document and presumably in the documents you've been working with on that side would be canceled for fiscal 83 and for years thereafter because there would no longer be that program. Instead, this legislation would spring into effect, one of the alternatives here. And so we have structured the fiscal note about what it would cost to implement these programs, which explains, in part, the dollar amounts being as large as they are and why there are as many different notes. Briefly, as an overview, and then I'll turn over the detail and the ability to respond to questions to Phil, we have the Administrative Services and Public Services Divisions. We have a joint fiscal note together, which is explained in greater detail in the attachments to it. But basically, this is the part of going out and getting the dividends out to the people, helping them fill them out, getting the dividend applications back in, processing them, entering them onto the computer, and issuing the checks, including postage. Postage, by the way, is a non-trivial sum. If you send out a quarter of a million checks in a year, that's $50,000 of postage. And that's not counting the envelope or anything else. So this program piles up costs in a big hurry, and especially when we're talking about potentially adding the 18-year-olds. As they turn over, they augment that pool of checks that are going out. We also have a fiscal note from Treasury Management, which is to manage the dividend fund established separately from the regular treasury. It has to be invested under a slightly different schedule in order to have maturities at the time the checks will go out. And safekeeping fees and things like that are associated with just keeping that money invested and earning income. We also have a fiscal note from the Enforcement Division, which is the division to make sure we're not having cheaters. And basically does the spot verification, and if there is any fraud going on, it would be the agency that would be responsible for developing the civil or criminal actions that would be taken in response. And then finally, we have from our research department an estimate of what it would take to fund the actual amount of dividends to be distributed, and that's the last fiscal note that we submitted.
Commissioner, what was that figure then? Where do we find that? Is that the...
That's the one that's blank, isn't it?
That's the one that's blank.
On page two...
That's right.
No, on page two, you have the three cases.
Okay.
And that gives you, if you have the existing law and you allow the payment to the children who turn 18, as they turn 18, then that's the projected amount of dividend expenditures. Case B is the per capita flat payment approach, and case C is the prospective accumulation of shares, namely that slim chance case, I think was described as a slim chance in the testimony this morning by Susan Burke, where the only defect is starting to count from 1959, if that's what the Supreme Court rules. So that's case C.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, is there anything in the budget, the current fiscal year 83 budget, that would fund the current program if the Supreme Court found it acceptable? Is that you already have the information and things are ready to go, so there would be no additional expenditure needed?
Go ahead, so why don't you answer that?
Mr. Chairman, if I may. The present FY83 budget contains the ongoing resources distribution and bringing in and processing the 1981 application, and those are coming in at the present time. We have about 125,000 of those in-house and a very vigorous volume coming in daily. There is, in the total distribution program, should the federal court approve it, the need, though, for a supplemental appropriation, as the prolonged period of time that we have incurred waiting for a decision has caused the total appropriation to be used. And there is the need for an appropriation to make the distribution of the payments for 1979 and 1980. And that has been submitted to the legislature as a supplemental appropriation.
So, Mr. Chairman, am I correct if this legislation for some reason does not go forward, we're going to need the supplemental? If this legislation goes forward, will we be able to drop that supplemental, or is that still going to be needed? Is that included in here? I'm just trying to get that straight.
Mr. Chairman, that is included in this fiscal note. The assumption was made that should the federal court not uphold the present program, then immediately all resources relative to that program would then be null and void.
No. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wall, what is the amount of the supplemental now?
It's $409,000, I believe. And then, that's a round figure. I'm not sure if it's a round figure in the supplemental.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no specific questions, but...
Senator Simpson, do you have any questions?
Well, just one, and I'm not sure that... these folks are the best ones to answer it, but let me try anyway. A question was raised in regard to the longevity bonus and whether this program impacts that at all. I can't see where it does, but I wanted to raise the question.
The longevity bonus?
Yeah, the Pioneers longevity bonus.
Well, I wouldn't know that from personal experience, obviously. The
It's coming.
It may not be there when I'm ready. I believe that that's funded on a formula basis based on X dollars per month if you meet the requirements, regardless of how much income you're making. And so I think the only interrelationship would be a legal one if there's a constitutional problem with a dividend concept, that there might be some fallout about the various length of residency requirement for that program.
I see what you're saying.
But that'd be the only sort of link I would see. I don't see how a distribution of these funds would make any difference. For instance, I could think of some prominent wealthy Alaskans who I think qualify for the longevity bonus program because they put in their time. And they'll get the same amount as someone who's lived in a subsistence lifestyle their entire life and have no monetary resources built up, although great cultural resources.
Is there currently any consideration for adjusting the dividend payment for any purposes, such as child support enforcement or something like that?
Well, it's best to keep the dividend concept strictly apart from any notions of need or as replacements for need programs. The reason for that is that the Supreme Court of the United States is very clear in its rulings that if you grant or withhold benefits that are based on need, then you cannot look to whether a person has been a resident or not in terms of making the decision how much you give them. If need is the criterion, then need is what you use. And 30 days is as much residency as you can require. So if there's an interrelation that were to be established between the dividends and child support payments, and one was a credit against the other or an offset, then you'd be going into that area where the cases are very clear. You cannot go constitutionally.
Is that right? So the state would be precluded from attempting to do anything like that then?
Directly through the dividends. Now, if the dividend distribution, this is a different issue from if the dividend distribution had an impact on federal welfare payments or whatever. I mean, we can insulate and have insulated the state welfare programs from the impact of a dividend distribution. But they may still have an impact on the federal welfare payments, as was described this morning. If they did, you would want to take care of that by program other than a residency-based distribution system. Because once you get into the residency, you cannot use more than 30 days residency to confer need benefits, whether it's child support or food stamps or whatever it may be, medical assistance.
Good. That helps me put that in perspective a little bit better. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could have Mr. Beatty and Gordon Landis from the Health and Social Services. I think there have been some discussions since our meeting about this issue of the welfare payments, and I think they can make it all very clear to us and simple, and we can perhaps act on this bill today. Is that correct?
I hope so.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Rod Beattie, Director of the Division of Public Assistance. With me is Gordon Landis, who's our program officer for the cash assistance programs. And I do have a handout, which I've got a lot of them here. Seems that the single biggest problem with the current version of Community Substitute Percent Bill 842 is what the impact is going to be on public assistance clients. And the thing that has triggered that as a concern is that there's been some changes in the federal rules governing these public assistance programs in the last 18 months. And basically what happened is that previously money was predicted on a prospective basis in that you tried to anticipate what was going to happen in somebody's life and then build their budget and their cash assistance around that. So you could have a permanent fund appear and disappear essentially in a month and not affect their overall eligibility or their benefit level. But all the federal programs have gone to a form of budgeting called retrospective, which basically means that there's no free money in the system anymore. And they look at 2 months ago to see what your actual earnings or other unearned income, such as Social Security or child support, was, and then they base the benefit level on that, even if it doesn't hold true at that moment. So consequently, that really threw a loop into the whole permanent fund impact on public assistance recipients in that they no longer would just have that as an extra source of income in the year, but that it does have a part or play a part in what the actual grant would look like in any given month. And right now, I think Committee Substitute Percent Bill 842 deals with that better than anything else in the legislature, that either the heritage payment bills or any other version of the permanent fund bills. And what it attempts to do is make sure that nobody is, in fact, hurt and suffers a net loss as a result of the permanent fund distribution. And as was said earlier this morning, there are approximately 50,000 people in the state who access public assistance programs in any given fiscal year. And most of those would be affected by a permanent fund distribution of any kind. What we've got is essentially an example sheet here. There's three different examples that we've constructed. And these are pretty typical of what you might find in the public assistance caseload right now. And I would just guess that it's approximately one-third of the caseload distributed across each of these examples. But there's two columns. One is the normal program without the permanent fund program in place. And the second column is the same set of circumstances interjecting 842 and a $1,000 distribution for each adult. The first example deals with an AFDC family of four where there's one adult, three children, no income in the situation. And those hieroglyphics on the side stand for aid to families with dependent children. FS is food stamps. And there's the energy program, the Medicaid program, and then the permanent fund program. And we've given you an annual as well as a monthly amount for comparison purposes. And as you can see, it's approximately $15,857 by our best estimates, type of assistance that that family would get without the permanent fund. If you inject the permanent fund of $1,000, it causes them to lose eligibility for 1 month, because that money is then calculated as income, and in all cases would throw those families over the income qualifying limits. And they would lose AFDC and food stamp eligibility for a one-month period. So we've reduced those annual amounts by 1/12 and then spread that across the year to get a new monthly equivalent. The energy payment would continue to be made. It's not affected by the permanent fund. We would have a medical safety net in 842, so they would continue to get the medical coverage, so there'd be no appreciable reduction there. And then the permanent fund, of course, would come in. As you can see in that particular case, there's a $15,951 annual equivalent compared to without the permanent fund, there's a $94 gain in that particular example. In the second example, we've selected an old age assistance household, which is somebody over the age of 65. And assumed a $250 last longevity bonus, which is present in most of those cases. And then we have old age assistance, food stamps, energy, the longevity bonus, Medicaid, and permanent fund. As you can see, they're not eligible for food stamps. Their income does not permit them to participate in that program. But the same set of events occurs there. There's a $10,877 annual benefit equivalent without the permanent fund, $11,351 with the permanent fund, approximately a $500 gain in that particular case. In the third example, which is somebody who's just accessing the food stamp program and energy assistance, otherwise working with a $950 gross income, two adults in the situation, the annual benefits without the permanent fund, including their income, comes to $13,193. With the permanent fund is slightly over $15,000. Almost total recovery of the $2,000 permanent fund in that particular example. What 842 does is build this level of a safety net into the public assistance programs, in that it would be very tough to construct an example where somebody would come out losing on the distribution. The administration part of it was mentioned earlier this morning as being as seen as a real disaster in terms of trying to re-enter these programs after 1 month, re-enter these people into the program after 1 month of discontinued benefits. Right now, we don't believe that would be the case, that we would not have to terminate everybody. We'd simply put them in a suspended status. And all of these cases are reporting on a monthly basis now anyway, so that we can determine their next month's benefits based on their past month's income. So we would simply expect the same document to come in from them, and we would re-enter them within the 30-day time frame that we're required to do it within. But we have got a fiscal note for 8 seasonal positions and $100,000 worth of overtime in order to pull that off.
Mr. Chairman, Rod, has that fiscal note been entered in? I don't think we have that.
No, in fact, the position paper and the fiscal note are with us, but we haven't passed them through the commissioner's office yet, so they aren't officially submitted.
And what is the total on the fiscal note proposed?
Under this particular strategy, there's the medical safety net will cost in the area of $2 million. There's a total savings across our programs for that 1 month of non-participation of about $4.4 million. So there's around $2.4 million net savings in program money and around a $200,000 price tag for the administrative costs of the seasonal and overtime.
So am I correct in about $1.8 million in net savings?
It's
is that correct?
Around $2 million, right.
Around $2 million. Okay. So there's not a negative impact.
That's correct.
A positive
right.
impact.
The other extreme is to have a complete safety net and continue those programs plus the permanent fund. That, on this particular bill, would be priced out around $7.5 million. So you add the $2 million that we were to the good in this particular case, and you have about a $9 million range there in terms of the different things that could be done.
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, this gets down to a policy issue as to whether we're going to attempt to hold harmless in this area. It sounds like what I think I hear the department saying is that you don't see a negative impact, but it's relatively minor benefit in the case of, in certain cases.
That's correct.
And what kind of problems would we run into if we attempted, say, to hold harmless with a 7.5 or in excess amount of funding? How difficult would that be to?
I think it would inject a real difficult management problem in that if you hold them harmless, there's no incentive then to dispose of that $1,000 permanent fund.
Now, would you say that again?
If they're held harmless in it, they also get the benefits as well as the $1,000 permanent fund. They're pretty much at their own